Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, this is a Media Project that is a bit unusual because we're going to be missing terribly one voice. Dr. Shartok is off on vacation. Will we get by?
Hello. Shall I step in and insult you here now?
That would be great. Just interrupt.
Something about your hair or your height or something.
Hello, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. That's Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at the University of Albany, whom you've heard. And chuckling on the sidelines, restraining herself, is Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. You are just called editor, right? You're not called
correct
to this, because you know when we have Stu Shinsky on, he's the executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. So
no,
in fact,
when I obtained this title, my mother was a little disappointed because she said it sounded not as impressive as
demotion,
managing
because you've been managing it, right?
Oh, they demoted you, dear.
Yeah,
oh.
You got a shorter title. Oh, anyway, here we are.
So you two are like major competitors.
Well, yeah,
will there be fireworks because of that?
Oh, yeah.
This is the Alan Shartok imitation.
Would you two please fight on the floor? Anyway, well, you know, competition is interesting. There is competition these days, but it's kind of different because there's so many more competitors, because in the internet world, you know, we're competing against everybody in the world, right?
And this market we're in, the Capital District of New York State, is a very heavily competitive market. We've got 5 or 6 newspapers, a lot of TV and radio stations,
radio,
including
right.
WAMC.
Mm-hmm.
Local. So it's when there's a big event like there is in this week, that we had 2 presidential candidates in town, there are a lot of people that show up.
Yep, absolutely.
I mention this also because one of the big stories of the week is about a massive and unprecedented cooperation among news professionals in the Panama Papers.
Yes, and that is interesting. Does that work on a local level? I wonder if it would. I wonder if there would be, have we ever done a collaboration of?
No, but we do collaborate with the local television stations, but
yeah.
The newspapers directly have not collaborated.
And this collaboration, the ICIJ, International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, are you a part of that organization?
Yeah. Yeah, I work for OCCRP, another acronym stands for Organized Crime and Corruption Project.
Mm-hmm.
But they are one of the players with whom ICIJ,
mm-hmm.
they farmed out the materials. You need to set it up, I think, Rex, but some 11.5 million documents.
Yeah, you know, this is what
reporting.
We're hearing all this stuff about, you know, the Prime Minister of Iceland and the question about the relatives of the leaders of China and other nations, which have taken a look at collaboration or let's say under the radar investments, questionable investments in the billions of dollars of very powerful people around the world through a Panamanian law firm. And this has been going on for what, a year?
For 1 year. It began with a massive leak, even bigger than the Snowden leaks, of documents from one law company in one of the tax havens of the world. And it was leaked to a paper in Germany. And those two reporters, investigative team there, realized that, we can't do all this. So they brought in the ICIJ, which has a history of doing these massive joint projects around the world and, in fact, has done work in the past on offshores. And so they farmed out the material to groups, including the one I work for in Southeast Europe, to take a look at something that didn't happen, by the way, with WikiLeaks, which just dumped all these documents.
Mm-hmm.
They have not done that. They sent the documents to these groups, which have spent the better part of a year.
In 80 countries, 100 different media organizations, and more than 370 journalists working on this, which is, when you have 11.5 million records, which they say is 2.6 terabytes of data. I don't exactly know what a terabyte is, but it's a whole lot.
And the meetings were, the groups met together and communicated, but it was really secret. I have not been in Europe in that time I've been here, and I only found out about this the week before they began publishing. So it's an unprecedented level of cooperation and secrecy. And I guess we can talk about the effectiveness. Before we came in, Judy was saying, well, it's not that impressive.
You know, when time will tell, I imagine, but to deal with that amount of data, I love the idea that they all collaborated, because I think that is the only way you can actually get at it. But I think in the next year or so, we'll see what else is in there that maybe the initial round of investigation missed.
That way, because you could then focus on what is interesting to your particular community. If you're a newspaper in Germany, you can look at the impact in Germany, perhaps it's a relationship with something in France, but then a French publication would do otherwise. But having it all at once, having a bunch of organizations and having say, okay, this is going to be the release date, that gives it sort of critical mass that gives the impact.
That's what they called it. Is ICIJ called it critical mass and said, in fact, that in the coming weeks they'll be picking extra partners to go after further stories. They did the low-hanging fruit right away. They did Iceland, which had an immediate impact. That's a small country, so a protest has immediate impact. Their head of government had a secret company with his wife, and he set this up the day before a new law went into effect that would have required him to disclose it. And that company got bailout money that he, as head of state, helped to negotiate the government to give to banks. So it's pretty direct conflict of interest. He's immediately out. China and Russia has very damning information about their... Yeah, well, in China, it is the head of government, but people close to the heads of government who are setting up these secret tax-evading organizations in places where they could really use the money. So the response in those authoritative places have been censor it. Can't find it. You can't find it.
Those citizens don't even know what.
Well, they actually do, and there's all kinds of, because we have social networking.
We have social networks, right?
And so people are talking about it. And in Russia, he has called it the work of, government operatives, American government operatives. My organization takes money from the U.S. government and from Soros, liberal leaning. So they've been under attack for what are your motives in this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our motives are a great story.
Yeah.
And, to me, the person I think who should be taking advantage of it is Bernie Sanders, who the capstone of his whole campaign has been that we are under horrible corporate control. They're evil. They have tentacles throughout the world, and we're at their mercy. This kind of backs that up when you consider that it's one law firm in one of the tax havens in the world, and all of this has come out.
Hmm.
The press has been criticized for not playing this. The American press has been criticized for not playing this heavily, in part because it doesn't have a lot of U.S. resonance at this point. We'll see if that develops. I mean, we have played it as well as we can, but we're not getting a lot of stories today. We saw the CIA-related story.
Yeah, the law firm from which the documents came apparently was used by the CIA to do exactly what we're accusing the criminals of, setting up a secret organization, basically so they could move arms, money and arms, to illicit groups that were not supposed to have anything to do with. Love the CIA.
Yeah, absolutely.
The real reason, I think, though, that the American papers have not gotten involved, that would be the Washington Post and the New York Times, is that the Washington Post and New York Times do not share. They don't want to have some little group like OCCRP or even ICIJ involved. They want to do their own investigations.
So they're not a part of ICIJ, and therefore those who were in this country include smaller papers like the Charlotte Observer, the Miami Herald, the Washington Bureau, the McClatchy newspapers. So there has been some out of that. But because it's not individual politicians in the United States who so far have been implicated in any wrongdoing, I think Judy's right that we just haven't had as much of a reason to give it huge play. That said, there was immediate criticism for the new New York Times public editor said, why is it that the initial story on this in the New York Times was simply picking up a wire story? There wasn't much attention to this by the country's biggest newspaper.
Because the other guy got it, and that's the hard truth. And the New York Times will come back. They'll have follow-up.
Right.
I think there may never be, out of this set of data, information about Americans. There's lots of reasons for Americans not to use Panama as the place to set up their haven. In fact, New York is a great tax haven. There's lots
right.
of
Right. We already here. Have tax havens
So why
here.
go to Panama City when you can just right. come right here? Or Delaware.
Go to Delaware,
or
sure.
South Dakota, or Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of places right here.
Where we avoid taxation, as we know, which is a constant theme. But, this kind of collaboration wouldn't have been possible before the internet age. This was set up by password secure encrypted collaborative forums, kind of like what was described by one of the journalists as like a private Facebook for journalists. And there was an authentication protected search engine. I mean, it was a very complex thing that enabled it to be done.
Well, even the transfer of 11.5 million documents could not have been accomplished in an earlier time.
Right. You know, we do collaborations as we speak. My paper publishes on the front page a story written by ProPublica that was offered to us, which was the, you know, as a not-for-profit newsroom that does a lot of its own work, but they work through other entities because they don't have a print partner. They don't have legitimate. In fact, we were the first paper that published a ProPublica story, which became the cornerstone of the anti-fracking movement in this state, and back when ProPublica was just setting up. So, you know, we do collaborate to a certain extent, and as Judy says, we have broadcast partners. We don't do it as much with each other.
Competitors.
Yeah, right.
I guess that's just a legacy holdover.
Well, and it's because we overlap enough in geography.
Well, we look forward to future cooperation.
Right.
As we readers.
Well, there is something to be said for that. You know, we did for some years support an organization that collected data for us on real estate sales.
Mm-hmm. We still do. And
do
we collaborate when there are instances where we will fight for a document to be made public.
Yeah.
We will definitely work together on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we used to do police blotters, I think.
Yep.
And not so much.
Open the courts to public photography.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that. So we're not, you know, competition isn't the biggest thing, but, you know, there's still a level of that that goes on. And there is actually another element that we get kind of annoyed about in our own newsroom, and that is not invented here. When there's a story, a really good story in a competitor, the typical response in the newsroom is to say, well, no, that's not really, you know, we already had that.
Yeah.
We've all heard that so much.
If I had a nickel for every time I've heard that.
We had that. And, you know, the right response, easy for me to say this as an editor, not covering a beat where I'm beat, is the right response to say, let's take this story and make it our own. Do something to carry it to the next day and go forward with it and give credit in print, you know, as first reported in the Daily Gazette. That's hard for people to do who have, mm-hmm. a competitive streak. But, you know, we should. Anyway, so we probably ought to talk just a little bit about the presidential campaign. If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. We have Judy Patrick, Rosemary Mayo, and Rex Smith here. And if you want to be a part of the conversation, we are media@wamc.org. You can send us email and offer your own views about this. We'll try to get to it next week. Anyway, the presidential campaign, Megyn Kelly, who has been one of the media stars of the campaign, I guess it's accurate to say that, was being interviewed by Katie Couric. Now, if that isn't an interesting notion, a Fox News host being interviewed by the woman who was the groundbreaking woman anchor of the CBS Evening News, groundbreaking in that she was the first solo female anchor, I believe, of one of the major national mm-hmm. newscasts. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
And so here they are on a for-profit event at the Lincoln Center. But anyway, they were talking about this, and the question was, what is with this Donald Trump attacking Megyn Kelly? And Megyn Kelly revealed that before the campaign launched, Donald Trump was cultivating her, basically, sending her nice little notes and calling her about
complimenting her about segments.
Isn't that interesting? And I guess we see that sort of thing, right? We have
all
people currying favor with journalists.
You can curry favor with them in many ways. You can tell them they did a great job on a story. You can give them tips, and it's something editors always have to school reporters on and resisting that. They're not your friends. They don't really like you.
Right. They don't really like you.
Once you lose your job, you're no longer their friend.
When they start calling you bimbo on Twitter, that's a hint. They don't really like you. Let's not get too excited about all the women in TV top spots, however. They only started getting them when TV began going down the tubes and the internet began hurting them the way it has print.
That's interesting.
You know, I once went to the Fox homepage and looked at all their female anchors, and they were, I would say, 99.9% blonde.
Yes, it's fascinating.
Really?
And so was CNN.
Hmm.
As a dark-haired person, I, of course,
and as a gray-haired.
Well, you know, why are all the thoroughbreds bays, you know? You don't see a gray in a race at Saratoga very much, do you?
I realize that.
Yeah.
Thank you for comparing women to horses, too.
I generally bet on the gray when it comes up. I think they're beautiful. But, you know, you can understand if you
nice
look at
save.
Me. Yeah. Anyway, one of the issues that Megyn Kelly raises, which may be a valid complaint, I've been resisting people who say, oh, you and the media are responsible for the Trump phenomenon. And I'm saying, no, we are not. But she does point out that the cable channels would carry live entire Trump rallies. I don't know if that's still the case, but...
It is indeed. I've watched them recently. Well, amazing. You know, CNN has done this too, and there have been other things. I mean, how many interviews have we seen where Donald Trump is sitting in the Trump Tower, in the seat of his power, with a kind of all business and gold fixtures all around him? Does no one get that that plays into his hands?
Right. The night of the debate, which he went to the Veterans Organization rally right. instead of heading the debate, the networks were doing side-by-side coverage. They weren't really covering the debate. They were more covering the Donald Trump, you know, appearance at the Veterans Affair. So, and anytime there's a question, even when Trump's not in the room, it's a Trump question. Well, how do you respond to this that right. Trump said? And in many respects, that's legitimate because he's raising these interesting issues that other candidates need to address, but the cable stations just keep bringing it back to him. Obviously, they're getting good ratings from this.
As the New York Times said, there's a disturbing synergy between Trump and the media. Even Megyn Kelly, she's got a book coming out. If we buy that book, why are we going to buy it? Because of Donald Trump. So her enemy, the guy who calls her bimbo, is also going to make her very rich, I think.
And where are people getting their news today? They're getting their news from cable news stations. They're not reading the newspapers like they used to, so they're not getting that kind of information.
To the extent that they are getting any news, it's important to point out that the numbers for cable channels are still far below those for network news, but for networks, the broadcast networks, but the fact is people are not going for news as much as they used to.
It was great this past week to see one of the cable news anchors, Chris Matthews, who I usually detest, actually did a fantastic interview with Trump. And he did it by breaking the rules, the reasons I don't like him. He talked about his own views. He interrupted constantly, broke off in mid-sentence. He hectored Donald Trump, the hectorer of all times. Excuse me, versus, you can't get out of this. You have to answer it. And it was an incredibly revealing, not good for Trump, actually, interview.
Mm-hmm. You know, but Trump supporters saw that interchange is just another example of the media coming down hard on Trump and not being reasonable. I heard many comments about that, you know, that whenever you press him too hard, or that Chris Matthews had an agenda, which
Well, his agenda is to try to get a candidate to answer a question.
Well,
we know that. But
to get off the talking points.
Yeah.
I laughed because you remember Katie Couric, again, her question to Sarah Palin in the previous election.
Right.
What newspaper do you read? And a week later, the opposition was saying, that's a real gotcha question. Like, what newspaper? Chris Matthews had a gotcha question. It's like, okay, if you think abortion should be banned, shouldn't there be a punishment? That's a gotcha question.
Yeah, it's become a sport in my house to watch television and to understand any time a politician actually really answers the question asked, because it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Rare.
Yeah. And, you know, I worked in politics for a few years, and the coaching that you give your candidate is, you don't have to answer the question. You answer the question you want to answer. And that is very much what a politician is trained to do.
Well, and look what happened to Trump. He has been punished for his honest answer about what he feels about punishment on abortion. So do you think he's going to do that again? Will he be more careful the next time not to answer the question? Yep.
You know, one of the interesting things, and Rosemary, you can shed some light on this because you deal with young people all the time. We're concerned that young people aren't paying attention to the news. And a recent study, a Gallup poll of college students, is interested in finding out what they say. And the fact is that young people, 59%, have little or no trust in the press to report news accurately and fairly. 20% of college students say that if they're looking for good information about the world, they, quote, would go to newer digital-only news sources such as BuzzFeed, Mike, or Huffington Post. You know?
Well, what can I do to shed light except to confirm that? You know, I'll put in an assignment. I'll say, find a story that shows, that you think shows bias. And I'll say it can be online, it can be newspapers, it can be magazines, it can be anything. And it's usually blogs or Huffington Post. And they're not offended by the bias. One journalist brought in a story about Donald Trump. And I'm reading the story saying, where's the bias? And this is pretty fair. For he did this, on the other hand, that. And then you come to the end, there's an editor note saying, Donald Trump is a bigoted, a misogynist, a whole string of adjectives like that. That was the editor's note on it. Huh. And she pointed it out because that was the assignment. But she was not really offended by that little edit note. Which had nothing to do with the story.
Amazing.
So doesn't this mean, though, all of the population has this, that they're not well-schooled? Our American citizenry does not appreciate, yes, you know, the importance of free speech and the role of the press. And maybe it's because we don't teach civics like we used to, or we don't. I mean, I think maybe my parents' generation had a better handle on it than even my generation does. And definitely those young kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't understand so many things. They will repeat things they read online. And you do have to challenge them. All we can do is just one by one say, where did you get that? Let's check that out and see if it's true. And right, you can point that it's
so true. If you're teaching journalism to undergraduates, you have to, you can't even get to this higher end stuff that a lot of the folks are urging, why aren't you teaching data visualization, for example?
I know.
You're really working on the fundamentals, right?
News? And Rex, you know this. You've talked a lot about media literacy. We're trying to teach students what you're talking about, Judy. How do you know this is an ad rather than a news story, or vice versa? They're very similar these days, and the students really don't know. They don't get that. So, yeah, I'm trying to teach them that. What is a story? That's the hardest lesson I find in May. What's a story? And I see them everywhere. I know you do, too. I could never write all the stories that I thought of. And they'll be talking about something, and I'll say, oh, my gosh, what a great story. And they look at you blankly. They don't see it as a story. So it's a hard concept to teach. And then I read a study like the one you're referring to, which is they're coming out of journalism schools and they don't know data visualization. They don't know budgets. Let me give you a hint. They don't know something as basic as a budget.
Yeah.
Or grammar.
Or percentages, or what the difference between a margin and ratio when you're dealing with a poll.
That's right.
Data is really scary to them because they're afraid of the math thing that you're referring to. Yeah, they want nothing to do with it.
Right.
That's a fault of our lower level schooling. Before they get to me, they've got to know math. Yeah. Why do I get students who, when I say, why do you want to go into journalism, they go, oh, I always did well in writing.
Yeah.
It's easy.
Right.
Let's take the gut course.
I get that, too, from job candidates. Why do you want to be a reporter? Oh, I've always loved to write. And I feel like saying, well, then go sit under a tree and write. Because what we do is we report. And sometimes it is done by writing, sometimes by photography, by video, by charts. We have some reporters now who are really good at creating charts and so on. And actually, this study that you're talking about is a Knight Foundation-funded study, Teaching Data and Computational Journalism. But before you can get to computational journalism, you have to teach how to compute,
I have to say, I teach a lot in foreign countries, and these are professional journalists, but at a kind of lower level, beginners. And we'll bring in some of the people you're talking about, the experts in the world on data visualization and data journalism and analysis. And I sit through those lectures, and those kids, those young reporters, are not getting it at all. They're listening politely, and they see the possibilities, but they're not going to go out and start doing a data journalism story tomorrow.
You know, it's interesting. I went through some 100 resume packets recently for a fellowship program that we're selecting folks for. And these are really outstanding young journalists, college students mostly, just now graduating. And a great number of them now are including data visualization on their resumes, basically to show me that they know how to make a chart, I think, showing what their percentage of skill level is in these various different skills.
Wow.
And it's kind of cute, I guess.
For the first time, I'm looking at candidates as well, and I got a Twitter portfolio.
Ah, really?
Did you like it?
I did like it. I thought it wasn't, because I would have checked it out anyway. And this way, yes, it makes it easier for me.
I love that in journalism schools, we're supposed to be teaching students these skills. When we do promotions, packages for tenure or promotion, it has to be written out. I do a blog. I had to print out my WordPress blog onto a piece of paper so that my superiors judging me could read it. So Knight Ritter, there's a whole lot more to do.
Yeah. We need to work on the faculty if we're going to get to the students. Yeah, that's very interesting. Train the trainers, I guess that's the thing. Well, I guess we're out of time. This has gone quickly, and nobody's insulting.
I feel like I had a lot more time to talk this week.
Alan, we miss you. You know, it's just not as much fun. We probably have half the number of listeners at the end of this as we would have had,
He'll tell us that.
Yeah, right, exactly. The same way that Donald Trump, you know, fuels cable TV. Anyway, it's a wonderful thing. We're sorry to leave you. Rosemary Arameo and Judy Patrick and Rex Smith here with you for the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week.
For publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.